This podcast is a presentation of University of California Television. Like what you hear? Consider making a donation at uctv.tv/donate so we can continue to bring you more great programs.
All right, so let's get going with the second part of this afternoon's panel and presentations. We will have Q&A at the end of this set of speakers. We have three speakers. The first is going to be Tomoko Masuzawa, who is Professor Emerita of the History and Comparative Literature at the University of Michigan. She's born and educated in Tokyo and holds an MA degree from Yale, a PhD, of course, from UCSB in Religious Studies. She's a scholar of European intellectual history with a special interest in modern discourses on religion and the history of the human sciences. She's the author of two books and many articles, and has held a Guggenheim Foundation Fellowship as well as a membership in the Institute for Advanced Study at Princeton. She lives in New York City. And just as an aside, I mean, one of our most remarkable books is the one on Invention of World Religions, or How European Universalism Was Preserved in the Language of Pluralism. And I was looking through the index of that book recently, and I noticed that a lot of the figures of religious studies that she lists there, and that she, you know, incorporates in her discourse in the book, were ones that Walter Capps had featured in this book, Ways of Understanding Religion, that I was introduced to in 1972. And then I look at I open the book from the front, and then I see that actually this book is dedicated to the memory of Walter Capps, to reflect the connectivity, you know, in your career and your writing and things. Our second speaker is Julie Ingersoll. And she's professor of religious studies at the University of Florida. She's the author of several articles and books on religion and politics, violence, and the religious right. As a former student of Walter Capps, Julie works to make scholarship available and accessible to the public. And she has written for such outlets as The Conversation, Religion Dispatches, and The Huffington Post. Her most recent book is Building God's Kingdom Inside the World of Christian Reconstruction. Our third speaker this afternoon is Sarah McFarland Taylor, and she's Associate Professor of Religious Studies and American Studies, Environmental Policy and Culture at Northwestern University. She's the author of Green Sisters, A Spiritual Ecology, and Eco-Piety, Green Media and the Dilemma of Environmental Virtue. After earning her doctorate from UCSB, Sarah went on to earn an additional advanced degree in Media Studies from the New School in New York City. So let's begin then with Tomoko.
Thank you very much. Is this a good position for the mic? Yes? Okay, thank you. Of course, it's customary to start one's talk by thanking the host for the occasion. But my following that venerable custom today is no mere routine observation, because what's been given to me now is not only the opportunity to speak, but also a chance to be among some of my oldest friends in the very place we shared some years of our youth, and a chance to gather together again once again to remember one great absence, that of Walter's. So thank you, Greg and Dusty and all others who are involved in making this possible. Thank you very much. I titled this talk, Walter Capps and the Gift of Imagination, and I'm going to say something about what I owe to Walter, how he opened the horizon of scholarship for me, but I will be selective, quite selective, and focus on the one particular seminar that I took in my second year of graduate school, and the one that I recognize in retrospect that had a special significance for me. But then there are so many other ways in which my having had Walter as a teacher and my coming into his orbit guided me, sustained me, and enabled me ultimately to have a rather interesting and generally happy academic life, or any kind of academic life for that matter. Not easy, and I owe him a lot in all this. But these many other ways are not very easily enumerated or described. So I would just allude to these very in sort of what you might call intangibles by sharing a few images. Well, despite the graininess and it's being a bit out of focus and also the color being washed out over the years, because this is a regular print, right? I'm still very fond of this photograph because it's a vintage Walter and Lois. Right? To my mind, this captures so much of the warmth and cheerful assurance that the world of Walter and the person of Walter emanated. And it is also an apt reminder that how much of that world is about Lois. I took this photograph, by the way. This was literally decades before there was such a thing as an iPhone, 1976 to be exact. In those days, in order to take a photograph, you needed a special device called cameras. And I happen to have one because I grew up in the country where you have been handed a camera more or less as soon as you're done with the pacifier, if your parents can afford it. And in any case, by this time I had one. And I think also Lois seemed to have one in her hands as well, right? And well, it's just people generally made the point of bringing camera to any occasion that they might want to memorize and memorialize, and to keep that moment for an as yet unknown moment in the future and to share. And here we are. The future has arrived. In order to contextualize this image a bit, let me show you a few others from the same occasion, same day, same place.
Is that Tucker's Grove?
This is Casa de Maria. Right, no, I never thought I would have an opportunity to embarrass Ed Linenthal in public. But here he is, yes? Between two women he adores and admires, that is, lovely wife Ula and Lois. Okay. Now, you may notice that in those days, before the benighted ubiquity of selfies, people didn't always line up to pose. Right? Even when they were aware that the camera is pointed at them, it was still possible to capture something spontaneous. Those smiles weren't staged. They were directed at you, or they were for someone else off to the side. When I show these pictures to some of my colleagues elsewhere, read outside of California particularly, they couldn't believe that they were taken at an academic conference. Just too much sunshine, too many people smiling. And what's that palm tree doing out there anyway? Right? All that sort of thing. So, but this was an academic conference held at, not on campus, it's true, but Casa de Maria, a Catholic retreat facility in Montecito. Many of you know that, of course. Here in this picture, I handed my camera to someone else so that I can be in the picture. Right? Though I have no recollection whatsoever of the man who has his arm around me. I can tell you that standing next to Walter with white hair is late Jim Wiggins, a dear friend of Walter's, and professor at Syracuse, and a longtime executive director of, executive director of the American Academy of Religion. before Barbara DeConcini, by the way. Yeah. Next to Jim is, in fact, the guest of honor at the conference, and that is Jürgen Moltmann, standing on the right.
Oh,
yeah. And that would be Jürgen Moltmann, even though, of course, for most people who are physicists, he's a German, Reformed German theologian, right, from Tübingen. And for those of you who know about him, perhaps more familiar image might be something like this, yeah? Or in his younger days, like that. Well, but bring him to California and into Walter's orbit, then he can lose his tie and the jacket and some of that Teutonic seriousness, a kind of Il Penseroso kind of look, you know? And so, here he is, genially conversing with Father Vincent, a sociologist on the faculty at the time, but he was also a Benedictine monk, I was told. So, as for me, on the other hand, this is my second year in graduate school, and not being very familiar with matters theological, especially at that time, I can't recall the substance of the conference too well. But I do remember very well how the event concluded. In the evening following the academic program, we all went dancing, these two gentlemen included. And Walter, I think, was at least a co-conspirator, if not the chief instigator of this extracurricular activity. Anyway, we all filed into a bar in Montecito called Plow and Angel. And in fact, much to my amazement, that institution still exists, even though it doesn't look like, according to their website, nothing like what it was then. I mean, certainly it didn't look like any place that the bunch of graduate students would go dancing together with a few professors, Calvinist theologian, and a monk in town. But that's what happened, right? So, but now that we got to dancing, let me share one more photo and remember one more person. Standing next to Jim Wiggins in red short dress is Deborah Sills. As some of you no doubt recognize, yeah? And at the time of this photo, she was, like me, second year graduate student, but she was later to become Walter's trusted administrative assistant when he was directing the Center for the Study of Democratic Institutions. And Deb, well, she can get anyone to dance. And we lost her much, much too early. The last time I was here in Santa Barbara, another former student from my own class, David Chittister, took me to the cemetery where Walter is buried. And not too far from that grave is Deborah's. I'm not really an avid cemetery visitor, but that visit was very special. To be with a friend from many, many years ago, just to be close to the site of the absence of two people who had been dear to each of us. And I want to thank David for that afternoon, especially because he couldn't be here. So all of those people are, in a way, also populating this image. And these photos that I've shown you are saturated with all memories and all manner of memories and sentiments. But they are not copyrighted, so if anyone would like to have them, I'd be happy to share. Just ask Dusty, I guess, yeah. And now to the academic, promised academic part of this talk. This is the syllabus of the seminar I took with Walter in winter 1977. The document runs page and a half, and I'll be reading small parts of it. But again, I also asked Dusty to make some copies. So if anybody like this memento, you can have it. Now, you may be wondering whether I'm one of those people who would keep every syllabus and every scrap of paper on file forever. Well, I'm not. Though I have kept quite a few for a good many years, but this one is about the only one that I still think about from time to time. And also, I kept all the books I acquired for this course. And that was an amazing list, and I'll show you them. Religion and the Process of Visualization is the title of the course, offered through the College of Creative Studies. The subject is squarely religion, but religion considered from an unexpected angle. Religion not as an object to be sketched, defined, and classified like some sort of cultural specimen, but essentially as a problem idea, I like to call, as a discursive field, as something good to think with, as Levi-Strauss might say. The first paragraph reads, "The course is an experimental offering," no kidding, "proposed as an effective way of engaging in interdisciplinary work in the humanities. It is not a course that come ready-made," no, it didn't, "but one whose formation depends upon the interest and contributions of all who participate in the process, instructor and student alike." Now, I'm sure you've heard something like similar or similar sounding in the decades since. But this was no mere concession or accommodation of student interests that are so common these days. He really meant this, in other words. I think that he really did. In this proto-syllabus, I want to call it, we were given no itemized schedule of reading, as yet, anyway. No breakdown of assignments that might be helpful to, in a way, you know, calculate how to get a decent grade, right? None of that. What's front and center is an idea. This was a risk, of course. In retrospect, it seems to me that we were being gingerly challenged whether we could really steady ourselves to as we wade into a new unfamiliar waters. You needed a certain degree of tolerance for thinking under the condition of possibilities, not certainty. That said, this proto-syllabus already suggests several entryways or portals into this realm of uncertainty. The most sweeping signpost appears in the second paragraph. "The course defines," I'm quoting again, "the course derives from a simple insight, namely that religion and visualization have something directly to do with each other. Accordingly, this course experiments with the prospect that religion has more to do with ways of seeing or ways of ascribing order or ways of discerning patterns and so on." So what did this mean? This paragraph that follows begins to loosen this knot of so-called insight. By the way, whenever you hear simple insight from him, that was not to take it lightly. The course will focus on at least two phenomena which belong to the process of visualization and have also been tapped to give meaning and definition to religion, namely illusion and projection. Here, the point is to understand the visual dynamics of illusion and projection so as to penetrate the potential association with religion. So let me parse this a bit. in my own words, because this was my portal. When religion is deemed an illusion of projection, and these notions were often ascribed to certain left-leaning authors like Freud, Marx, and Weber, right? This is often taken to mean that these authors discredited or dismissed religion as falsehood. In many religion courses, this was reason enough to be done with these authors and move on. But in this seminar, we were invited to linger and to consider in earnest what is involved in the visualizing process. Call it projection, perception, cognition, recognition, projection, or illusion, for that matter. When a visual experience is deemed an illusion, are we saying that the perceiver committed an error of judgment in what they saw? If seeing or visualizing is a projection, does this mean the perceiver is being a bit overzealous, perhaps overactive, in structuring and constructing that experience so that they are in fact seeing more than what's really there, right? And you shouldn't be seeing all these extra things. Is that what we are saying? Or alternatively, could it be that the capacity to structure, construct, and synthesize is a necessary constituent of the components of the perception as such? You hear Kant coming in, forms of perception and all that, right? He's not disclosing. I don't think a name Kant didn't really appear, just in passing, you know. It's obviously an allusion here. We consider this question in the company of such authors as Rudolf Arnheim, Arnheim here, the psychologist and philosopher of art, and from a physiological point of view, in light of this fascinating book by British a neuropsychologist, I think you'll call him, Richard Gregory. But the closest and dearest to Walter's heart is, I think, this book, Art and Illusion by E.H. Gombrich. At that time, he was the director of the Warburg Institute in London, and Walter often spoke fondly of the year he spent at the Institute. Yeah. And by the way, when Gombrich came to speak at UCLA, Walter was nice enough to get the van and got a bunch of us to go hear him talk and introduce us to the speaker and so on. So he wasn't driving us always to the bar. Much as he was partial to art historians and scientists of vision, Walter's ambition is, in fact, was rather somewhat greater and theoretically broader. I think that might be a way to put it. And this is evident, for instance, is that the right thing? Yeah, from this penultimate paragraph. This is the end of that document. And then the penultimate paragraph. This paragraph, too, could use a bit of parsing. So let's say for now that this is his intent is to turn around or shifting the gear on what we disarmingly call often an apparatus to Western approach to, sorry. An approach to Western cultural history. That's his object, and doesn't specify yet that much. He's proposing to depart from the prevailing mode of conceiving this history as so many layered stories of organic rise and fall of divergent styles, right? And instead, to conceive of it in terms of the vicissitude of the forms of intuition. So that's, again, you know, you can smell Kant right there. Our guides in this part of the journey was such books as George Kubler's Shape of Time. This one just 70th anniversary just came out from Yale Press. I mean, classic, right? And also the same kind of thing. Stephen Toulmin and Jane Goodfield's The Discovery of Time. Space and Time, Forms of Intuition, yeah. So all that was kind of coming out. And then, let's see, and shifting the matter of paradigm, rather shifting to the matter of paradigms change, this was another book, a classic, Thomas Kuhn's Structure of Scientific Revolution. And in the same spirit, of course, Karl Popper. So those are our reading list. But at the same time, we were not just nudged to a more philosophical, theoretical, and abstract. Rather, Walter showed us some exemplary cases, exemplary cases that embody these possibilities, cultural history, and how we might turn the direction of this fully freighted Western cultural history, and I think this John Sesnick's Survival of the Pagan Gods is as good an example as it could be. This was a wonderful book. I still go back to. And so is Edgar Wind. So it seems befitting that the last book we read in the seminar was this slim volume, another work by Gombrich, with the title In Search of Cultural History, with a big question mark silently imposed on it. Yeah. The summary of what the course was that I had just given you is not something I could have given at the time when the seminar ended in 1977. If someone were then, asked me then, so how was the seminar? I would probably have said something like, well, very interesting, and I have no idea what happened. So nearly half a century later, I think I know a bit better what happened. Still, was this the grand plan already made it complete in Walter's mind at the time? Well, I'm not sure. And he didn't say it was, right? As you recall, he did urge us to take our thinking in certain possible directions, and he told us that these books will give us a good workout, and therefore it would give us good new muscles and strength to go forward. So 40 plus years on, I think I understood what we have learned, how we together, that is instructor and students alike, as he put it, how we contributed and collaborated, not just for the duration of the semester, but for me over all these decades. Walter has been teacher for life. Thank you.
Okay, Dusty promised me I was going to be able to handle this Mac without buttons. Thank you.
All right.
You can just use those to talk.
Yep, great. Hi, everyone. This is just such an exciting occasion. I also want to thank the CAP Center and Greg and Dusty for all your work, and I'm sure there were many other people involved in the work. This is a terrific event, and I'm really honored to be here. I was struck by Ed's comments about the talk in Minneapolis and how it had this sense of sort of coming home with Lois in the audience. And this is something of that for me. So anyway, thank you. The following is a preface from Walter's book from 1990. One of the things that's fascinating to me about the talk so far is how it doesn't sound like we all studied with the same person, right? We're all over the place. And we've had lists of books that Walter wrote, and the one that was important to me didn't show up on anybody else's list yet. It's just a fascinating fact. But anyway, so this is what he wrote in the preface to that. New Right Religion is a reluctant and unforgiving subject for a scholar in religious studies. By training and temperament, a scholar approaches subjects from this vantage point, that is, religious studies, is quite prepared to consider all fundamentalisms as probable exhibits of a sort of mental rigidity a more compelling human nature is obliged to overcome. New Right Religion is true believer religion, which, as everyone knows, is sometimes beguiled into dogmatic militancy and carries the ability, in some circumstances, to work pathological mischief on its devotees. This is still Walter. I did not undertake this project, I confess, as an advocate or out of deep personal empathy for the subject. It was simply that my curiosity, other people have spoken of that, my curiosity had been aroused by the fact that the rise of the new religious right seemed demonstrably out of touch with the real needs and deeper challenges of our time. Again, he wrote this in 1990. I wondered how this could be and how its proponents could respond to the course of human events in such peculiar fashion. Along the way, of course, I discovered that there was much more to the story than I had anticipated, and that the movement's advocates were quite able to explain their convictions on grounds they believed to be intellectually defensible. I also came to recognize just how easy it is to dismiss the religious right even before considering it or trying to comprehend it. I was caught in an unexpected place. I had not yet determined why religious right movements should have come to prominence, but I was developing confidence that there were such reasons. However, even to acknowledge this possibility is to ascribe a degree of seriousness to the subject that is inconsistent with the disposition among scholars to dismiss the matter out of hand. I think Wendy referred to that sense as Walter started getting interested in the religious right. This encapsulates so much about the interests that Walter and I shared, but more importantly, the way he approached his work that I have tried to emulate, the genuine curiosity and empathy even that he brought to everything, the real honest way he was interested in actually understanding people, even those with whom he would vehemently disagree. His desire to do work that was relevant to the issues of the day, and the biggest challenge for me, his enduring lack of cynicism. I want to focus on two themes. The first is the goal of understanding religion from the inside, including not only religions we're inclined to like, but also religions we may not, and how such inside understanding has helped my own work. And second, the importance of public scholarship. Tomoko, I just love the images. It was so fun to watch your presentation, and I was really thrilled when I found this one with the tuba in it online, but I didn't have any of my own. I was lucky to be a grad student at UCSB, to have multiple mentors who engaged me and supported me and challenged me, shaping my thinking. Clark Roof was my dissertation director, but Walter, in ways that were both direct and indirect, had as much impact on my academic trajectory as anyone else. He was an important member of my committee and one of my examiners, but his influence predates my time here at UCSB. When I was a freshman, I needed a humanities course, and I heard religious studies was an easy A. As it turned out, it wasn't easy. I took that course with Walter's first PhD student in his first year of teaching. Ed, we've gotten really old. Ed and I stayed in touch for years, and when I wanted to return to school to do some graduate work in religious studies, I called him, and he set me up with a meeting with Walter. Before long, I was renting a room from Walter and Lois. And sometimes in the morning, I'd wake up to Walter playing the piano downstairs. But other times, Walter and I stayed up late at night watching in the TV room televangelist Benny Hinn slaying his followers in the spirit in these massive stadiums. I don't know. I wasn't even doing a PowerPoint, and I said something to somebody about Benny Hinn, and I got this blank look. So I don't know that you all know who this guy is. But he was one of the real. If you hear about the new Apostolic Reformation movement that is really in prominence at the moment. He was one of the very earliest ones of these folks, and he would do these massive stadium revivals. I've got a picture of the size of the stadium, but he had just ripped off his coat and done this, and the guy fell down in the spirit. We had a lot of fun watching this guy. All over the stage, people were falling down, but this is the favorite stuff. So that's his hand down here, and what he would do is he would throw the Holy Spirit up into one quadrant of the stadium, and everybody there would fall down. And then he'd throw it over here, and everybody else would fall down. So it was a lot of fun to watch on TV. As Walter noted, there's something different about studying religion we don't like. I suppose with the religious right these days, this is even more clear, as they've become such a threat to democracy. The part of American Christianity that I write about has had many names. It was called the right. And then when Walter was writing, it was the new right, which meant we had to rename the old right. It's been called the moral majority with lowercase letters, not the organization, but just as a movement. It's been called the Tea Party. Sometimes it's just called evangelicalism, and now we're calling it Christian nationalism. The name changing has several implications, one of which is the loss of the thread running through all of these, the coherence and consistency of both the way they see the world and their plans for the rest of us. The name changing leads us to focus on surface issues like the next election cycle that, while important, also distracts us from what Walter pointed us to. The cultural transformation sought by the religious right that was, in his time, slowly and methodically taking place. The result is to obscure the real threat this admittedly theocratic movement poses to democracy. Let's make sure I'm on this. Okay. Actually, I'm one behind. There we go. More than 30 years ago, Walter warned not to dismiss this movement out of hand. He pressed for the necessity of understanding the power of the movement that came from its internal coherence, the consistency with which its followers were willing to work over the long term to bring about the change they sought. Specifically, I write about an obscure but important thread in Christian nationalism called Christian Reconstructionism. In the middle of the 20th century, Christian Reconstructionists drew on parts of the Calvinist Reformed tradition and Protestantism and the Old and New Testaments to develop what they call a biblical worldview. In this view, the Bible speaks to every area of life, and it's the job of Christians to bring biblical law to bear on every realm of culture and society. Santa Barbara's a bubble. And for those of you who didn't come from away, as we say in Maine, where I'm really from, I don't know that language resonates and that you recognize the depth of it and what it is really meant by all of it. I live in Florida, and this is the way people talk. This movement has infused the way people see things. I'm going to talk a little bit more about that. So they call this the dominion mandate from that given to Adam in the book of Genesis, and they intend for us to be a theocracy. More than articulating a theological system, the Christian Reconstructionists knew that to bring about their goals, they needed a multi-generational strategy to capture the institutions of society and change how people think. A key part of this has been the effort to dismantle and replace public education with private Christian education. And I'm sad to report that in many parts of the country, they're having a lot of success. Educational choice, parental rights, they sound like great advances until we see the big picture. Or as an important Christian Reconstructionist figure, Gary North, put it in 1982, so let us be blunt about it. we must use the doctrine of religious liberty to gain independence for Christian schools until we train up a generation of people who know that there is no religious neutrality, no neutral law, no neutral education, no neutral civil government. Then they will get busy constructing a Bible-based social, political, and religious order, which finally denies the religious liberty to the enemies of God. There are far too many components of this Bible-based social, political, and religious order to outline here. But since the 1960s with the Christian school movement, then later with the Christian homeschool movement, and exploding with the pandemic, this obscure version of Christianity has remade the separatist fundamentalism of the 1920s into a serious theocratic challenge to democracy. In the process, it has overtaken what was a broader evangelical movement and the Republican Party. I don't know how many of you watched the Republican debate earlier this week, but the attacks on universities came from every candidate, repeatedly and more aggressively than I've seen. And like I said, I live in Florida. Christian Reconstructionists have written publicly about their views and their goals for decades. But at the same time, they have functioned as something of a stealth movement. People dismissed them in the ways that Walter warned about. When I, along with a handful of others, began writing publicly about them in popular media around 2010, we were dismissed as alarmist by some who claimed that dominionism isn't a real thing. It's a real thing, isn't it? We've been talking about this. Christian Reconstructionist's broader influence is hidden. Sometimes that's because it's embedded in institutions and has taken hold among people who are unaware of its roots or its long-term goals. But this isn't unusual. None of us can really trace the roots of our ways of thinking. We might be able to hit some of the high points, but most of our sources get lost along the way. And that's true for those of us who spend our time thinking about thinking, those of us who would like to be able to trace all the sources. Most people don't even care. Other times, people embrace these ideas but reject the controversial label. There are a number of religious right leaders and institutions who have demonstrable ties to R.J. Rushdoony, one of the founders, and Christian Reconstructionism, but they don't wish for that to be known. You cannot track the influence of this movement by looking for footnotes and finding people who identify explicitly by the label. You have to listen for it. If you really understand their framing, if you understand their world from the inside, instead of dismissing them as not really Christian or just too far on the fringe to bother with, if you don't do that, you can start to hear their accent. And this brings me back to Walter's influence. One of the biggest challenges in my work has been scholars who want me to be able to supply traditional documentary evidence for the influence that I claim. I understand that, but it's not possible. And if we want to know how this relatively powerful faction in America, if we want to know what they're up to, we need the deeper understanding that Walter sought. The deeper understanding gives us access to the bigger picture. We have to see if we're going to address it. Importantly, it also helps us see, or better hear, the influence. I have some examples as I shift to the discussion of the importance of public scholarship. Like Walter, I never intended to be an ivory tower kind of scholar. Even less than Walter, I'm a lot more likely to go hang out with the Moonies than I am to dig through dusty old papers. So I count myself lucky when I get calls asking me to explain some development among the Christian nationalists. I do that because I still don't like to call them that, but I should stop. I've got to get over it. That's what everybody's calling them now, right? I know this world from the inside out, and I can identify influence that others might miss. It's in the language that they use. These are some examples. They talk about a biblical worldview. They use the language of patriarchs or patriarchy in a positive way. They talk about government schools instead of public schools. They talk about civil government instead of government. They talk about lesser magistrates. This actually comes from Calvin, but they're interested in dismantling the federal state, and they aren't satisfied with states' rights. They want actually county rights. So the discussion of lesser magistrates has to do with what they think is the power of local sheriffs to invalidate existing law because they have biblical authority to do so based on Calvin. They talk about biblical spheres of authority, which actually encompass everything. They talk about dominion, and they talk about covenant marriage. And this isn't to say that anybody who uses any of these terms is somehow a secret Christian Reconstructionist. But it is to claim that when contemporary discourse is consistently punctuated by these rather unusual terms, it's likely to have come from Christian Reconstructionists. And it's reasonable to inquire whether it also comes with a host of views about the world shaped by dominion theology. Most recently, I've been explaining to anyone who would listen, lots of reporters, that our new Speaker of the House, Mike Johnson, has been drinking from the Christian Reconstructionist well. Okay. I get asked if Johnson is a Christian Reconstructionist, and I don't like that question. I think it's the wrong question. The answer is I don't know. Maybe that's why I think it's the wrong question. Huh? What I do know is that along the way in his involvement among Baptists, Christian schools, and probably homeschooling, he has incorporated their way of thinking into his own. It doesn't mean he is one, but it means the influence is there. You can hear the echoes of it when they use these strange terms. Johnson began his term as speaker by claiming that God had put him in authority, and he said in an interview that the Bible is the source of his views on all issues. Most Americans hear these kinds of statements in traditional ways politicians have sought to solemnize our civic life, akin to "In God We Trust" on our money. While some of us may not like it, generally it's harmless. But these kinds of statements are a window into the way he understands the relationship between religion and government, and we should be paying attention. He's not just suggesting he looks to the wisdom of the biblical tradition to inform his positions. He's echoing a version of Christianity that literally teaches that the Bible, both Old and New Testament, speaks to every area of life. He's drawing on a way of reading those texts that prescribes everything from tax rates and the necessity of having insurance to whether regulating the internet is possible. Johnson has added a new term to my lexicon of language to look for. He's in a covenant marriage. Because Christian Reconstructionists built their system on the Reformed tradition and Calvinism, the notion of covenantalism is central. For a couple of decades now, churches in these circles have added their own sorts of requirement to the legal requirements for marriage and called these covenant marriages. The most important components are that the covenant puts the marriage under the authority of the church and makes divorce much more difficult. In many examples of covenant marriage, only the church courts can grant divorces. In most states in the U.S., the practice exists only within church congregations and apart from the state. But in a few U.S. states where power of this kind of Christianity has been enough to enact such laws, Johnson's state of Louisiana being one of them, a similar process has been written into secular law. Scholarship should matter. And as intractable as it seems that things are now, I can't help but wonder what Walter would say to us to do about it. Walter blended town and gown with grace. He didn't just use his expertise to weigh in on public issues. He used it to bring people along in their understanding so they could see what he saw. But he was able to maintain his hopefulness. I wish I were able to do that. The breadth of the arenas where Walter has contributed to public life is truly hard to grasp. We'll be hearing about some of the more well-known examples, but the true breadth was clear to me when I kind of randomly encountered an example about which I had known nothing. I spend as much time as I can these days in my camper. I'm looking for Clarence Thomas at Walmart. A couple of years ago, I was in a county park in San Luis Obispo and noticed a sign dedicating a lamp preserve to Walter Capps. I went up and looked around. I still don't know what it was about. I have no idea how that came to be. The people at the kiosk didn't know. But almost 25 years after his death, the new to me realization of the good that he brought to the world in ways both big and small made me smile. So I guess that's a little bit of hope. Thank you.
Set me up. Okay. Got myself timed here. big so I can see it. Awesome. Great. And I am actually going to use one of these mics because I've been furiously taking notes and want to integrate some of the themes that have come up into my talk today, which is on hope, and maybe that's a good note. Before we get started and before I do the thank of everybody, can everybody just stand up and stretch? Like, do the little teapot stretch? Yes, roll those shoulders. Okay, great. All right, now we're ready to dive into hope. So I appreciate the breadth that we were given to interpret this assignment of coming and talking at this conference. There are so many things I could say about my own personal experiences with Walter and how he was a beloved uncle-like person in my life. And often when I was feeling that kind of angsty doctoral student feel, the way he would just radiate positivity, hope, and would bring light to that sort of doom and gloom. And then also whatever drama was going on at the university, he was so able to, at least with us as students, interject this kind of humor into it and encourage us not to take ourselves so seriously, but to have a light touch. And so this actually comes into my discussion today of eco-talk, and these Gen Z eco-communicators that are really going across the zeitgeist of doom and gloom in terms of climate and are defiantly embracing and preaching climate hope. So I'm going to dig into that a little bit, but I think I may have solved Tomoko's question of what the conference that was keynoted by Multnomah was about. I believe it was about hope and the future of hope. I think that was the conference, that was the publication that came out of the conference. But one of the things that's been really lovely in doing this new project on Gen Zers and the digital space as a space of preaching, encouraging, I wrote a big, strong stars here, galvanizing hope among Gen Zers, among younger generations, has been going back to Walter's texts about hope and thinking with them. So a couple of themes that I pulled out, among other aspects, is Walter explored in writing and teaching and policy making, changing narratives of hope, the contrariness of hope, and I'm gonna mention that today in my talk, the structural dynamism of hope movements. How is it that there's sort of this school of hope he's talking about in the mid-60s, and then by the mid-1970s, he famously in the chapter of Hope Against Hope asks, what the heck happened? Where is hope? What happened to hope? The multiplicity and flexibility of hope, the entwined sociopolitics and implied theologies of hope. And finally, I want to concentrate on this last one, the inextricable ties between hope and imagination, particularly the capacity to imagine a better future and how that has implications for our very survival. So it's early days yet, but this is what the project looks like right now. Defiant climate hope, how Gen Z, what I call anti-doomers, are fueling climate action through their eco-communications and their defiant hope-filled media making. So some of this also comes out of a hope-filled course. I teach at Northwestern University for undergraduates and have for a number of years. I teach both in religious studies and in environmental policy and culture. And students were coming into my class largely from environmental policy and culture and environmental science, and every climate course they had taken had depressed the bejesus out of them. And after taking the course, they would say, hey, this was the first course I've taken on climate change that didn't make me want to slip my wrists. So one of the reasons for that, and that was by design, is in this course, I take this very soul-crushing, despair-inducing topic, but we get active in this course. So we make climate media in this course. As Juan mentioned, I went and got a degree in media studies after graduating with my PhD at UCSB, in part so that I could do this and write about this. So the first part of the course is we're analyzing climate media. What works? What doesn't? What's effective? How do we thread the needle of getting people concerned and moving them from concern into action without making people shut down from climate paralysis and climate anxiety? And it is a hard needle to thread. It is very easy for fear-based media communications to just, we've all done that. We've seen the headlines and we have just scrolled back down those headlines and just can't hear it, can't engage. And so we learn some strategies for how to get people to engage. And the students make their own media, and then we workshop that media in learning pods, and we get better at it. And they bring their own research on climate and become better climate communicators in the process. So part of my observing the students making their media, my students are Gen Zers, and I'll talk a little about generations in a second. Part of that and watching them make their own media and then looking at a lot of the media that they're looking at brought up repeatedly this realm of eco-talk. So when I talk about eco-talk, there are two realms here. There's a specific collective that calls themselves eco-talk of communicators who make all sorts of videos to organize, to educate about climate, to activate Gen Z and millennials, mostly on TikTok, to be involved in climate action. And then eco-talk is also used more broadly to talk about that sort of digital space where Gen Zs are making making videos and making media about this. But they're educating, they're talking about policy efficacy, and one of the things that's encouraging to me as someone who wrote a book, my last book was on eco-piety and green media and how we need to shift the conversation from those tiny little micro changes, like I've got a bamboo toothbrush and I used a paper straw instead of a plastic straw, and I recycled my coffee cup. All of that is great and we should all be doing that. However, in terms of the speed, scope, and scale that we need to make to address climate change in a way the Earth will actually notice, takes policy. So my repeated mantra in my class to my students is policy. It's what's for breakfast. It is what's for breakfast. And what's encouraging to see with these anti-doomers on TikTok, on EcoTalk, is they're getting that policy matters in terms of speed, scope, and scale to actually make a difference. Of the scale we made a difference when we had agreements to ban ozone-depleting CFC chemicals and other chemicals, that thank goodness that we did, because the climate change problem would be even worse had we not. So that's the kind of corporate, meaning all of us together acting, that's the kind of impact that we can have. And they, my students integrate that into their media works, and they look for that in terms of the media that they are consuming. So when I talk about climate hope, I often get the question, Sarah, is this all rainbows and unicorns and lollipops? You know, come on with the climate hope. We know we're all doomed. What's kind of interesting is on these eco-talks made by these anti-doomers, they acknowledge, they are not sugarcoating, they acknowledge climate grief and despair is real. They have been pickled in it throughout their education. Many of them, at least at Northwestern, they have been, but many of them on TikTok talk about having nightmares about climate change from the fifth grade on. But they're also, at the same time acknowledging that this is real, they're rejecting fatalism and galvanizing their viewers to enact systemic change. They're also a community of care and as well as a community of hope. Here's one of EcoTalk's, it's actually not their most recent post, but one of their most recent posts is entitled Resist Climate Doom. And here I have circled in my notes from your talk, Ed, a world given formation by hope, not fear. And how much this ties in to Walter's, as Julie said, refusal to be cynical, refusal to give up. Right? So sending this message, hope is more sustainable than fear. And then I love this comment here, joy is a form of resistance. That doesn't mean not being active, that doesn't mean sitting on your sofa, but this is actually borrowed. There's a lot of overlap between Black Lives Matter activists and eco-talkers, and this is actually comes from Karen Waldron's book, The Lightmaker's Manifesto, if you've read that, where she says, I refuse to feel guilty about feeling joy, even though the world is totally messed up and screwed up. That you owe yourself, what are you doing it all for, if you're not stopping and feeling the joy? And what's neat is that we're seeing these eco-talkers also saying, hey, don't forget joy. And that's what Walter was saying to us as graduate students when we were in our angsty doom and gloom, oh my God, and we're gonna, don't forget joy, because what are you doing that degree for? Or when everything was going horribly in Congress, well, it's pretty discouraging, but even so, don't forget joy. What are we doing it for, if not? So here's another posting that I love from EcoTalk. They're promoting OpenEDU, which is it's a climate change education program. But I love this image here, where here they have two routes depicted. One is towards outrage, clickbait, polarizing news, sensational doom and gloom. But there's another route that we can take, they say. There's a little bit of an off-ramp that goes in a different direction. And what is that direction? Solutions, creativity, innovation, storytelling, science, indigenous knowledge, open education, community, care, healing, joy, trust. All of these things that have come up today. So when I talk about these proponents of defiant hope, what do I mean by defiant? What are they defying? Well, we know from a number of studies, and I'm just going to mention two. One is from the Ipso Global Market Research Public Opinion Data, their solutions survey, that was a survey of 20,000 people in 27 countries, that 1 in 5 young people globally believe it's too late to fix climate change. We're screwed, it's too late. Go have a cheeseburger, sit on the beach. You know, might as well enjoy the way down. So this kind of fatalism is also reflected in the Young People's Voices of Climate Anxiety study that was done. Britt Ray, who's up at Stanford, was also involved in this study. She very famously wrote this book, Gen Dread. This is another phrase for both Gen Zers and younger millennials. Gen Dread surveyed more than 10,000 15 to 25-year-olds from more than 10 countries. 3/4 of the young people reported feeling the future is frightening. Half said humanity is doomed and reported that climate anxiety impacts their day-to-day lives. 39% fear bringing children into the world wrecked by climate crisis. And this tracks with my students, too. Many of my students say, I will not have, I mean, they're undergraduates, but they are saying, I will not have children. It is not ethically, morally fair to bring children into a wrecked world. So when I say defiant hope, and when Walter talks about the contrariness of hope, here we have in the EcoTalk anti-doomer movement, contrariness, right? Defiant hope going on. And this is what they are defying, the sort of prevailing zeitgeist, as it were. So anti-doomers defy fatalism. We also know from a number of psychological and sociological research that's been done, any of us who teach at university, we know that there's a huge mental crisis going on with our students, and yes, exacerbated by the pandemic. But here, the climate anxiety is a huge, huge component of why our students are having major, major mental meltdowns. They are carrying the world, the weight of a burning world on their shoulders. So these eco-talkers, these anti-doomers are defying the fatalism in this, defying the zeitgeist going on. They're being contrarian, and they're making it fun. TikTok is famous for their dances. Raise your hand if you have ever done a TikTok dance. Come on. What? We're the only two? Oh, y'all are liars. Nobody's done a TikTok. Thank you, thank you. This man has done a TikTok dance. So the genre, the platform itself is fun. It's playful. And we've talked a lot today about Walter's sense of fun and playfulness, that you walk in the room with Walter and you just felt the warmth. The warmth and the playfulness and the laughing, the smile that reaches his eyes, because he had that kind of laughter and spirit. So this happens to be not just sort of silly, trivial. We want to dismiss Sean, I think what you called the eco-talk generation. We want to dismiss them. But this is incredibly smart and strategic. First of all, doing this on TikTok, location, location, location. In addressing their peers to peer-to-peer conversation, they're going where their peers are. Their peers aren't going to somber documentary environmental climate films. Their peers are on TikTok. My teen is on TikTok. So using humor to address climate change rather than being sort of silly and superficial, this is brilliantly strategic. And if you don't believe me, you can read Max Boykoff's research at CU Boulder. We read his book on creative climate communications in my media course. And he finds, guess what? When you are dealing with soul-crushing, existentially devastating topics, if you can have a light touch, the way Walter often had a light touch. If you can have a light touch, guess what? People can go there. They can go there. They won't be paralyzed and shut down. So rather than the funny, silly approach being sort of flippant, it's brilliant. Here's an example. This is Zahra Biabani. She is a popular TikToker and media and eco-communicator. I don't know if anybody follows her here. Her TED Talk, where she talks about how Gen Z can become eco-creators in the digital space and help fuel climate action through this, making media as a bridge to policy, as a bridge to galvanizing support for policies that the Earth's gonna actually notice. So here she is doing her TikTok dance. Then she does her very serious TED Talk, but she also writes books. So let's not dismiss our TikTokers as being relatively illiterate and not doing serious work. But here is her book on climate optimism, and I added this little arrow here because she says in the subtitle here, celebrating systemic change around the world. Once again, she's getting it. It's, you know, a pox upon the plastic straws, but it's not about the plastic straws. It's about broader policy changes. I also receive her weekly newsletter, which is fabulous because each week there's a subject heading in my inbox that says Earth Wins. Earth Wins, and it's a list of good things that happened in terms of climate change and the environment that week, not the doom and gloom stuff. And she makes a point, do we need to be working faster? Do we need to be doing more? Absolutely-frickin-utely. But here we have Earth Wins. Here's an example of Earth Wins, and there's this is a feature done on her in 17 Magazine, so she's really resonating with a younger demographic. And then she has action items, and I love that her action items aren't, you know, You, Greg, personally, please do not drink almond milk that is unfriendly to bees. Instead, she says, help save bees by urging leaders to ban pesticides. She's thinking big. Policy. It's what's for breakfast. But there's also a little double entendre that's often used with the earth winds. It's that this defiant hope, earth is going to win out in the end, and let's keep going. She also takes a page out of climate scientist Catherine Hayhoe's book. This is an excellent book if you haven't read it, A Climate Scientist's Case for Hope and Healing in a Divided World. And we actually study, Catherine Hayhoe also did a famous YouTube series. She does great Instagram posts. She does a lot of social media. She's brilliant at this, but we dissect in class her climate communications. But I love this. She'll talk about, like, what's going wrong, and instead of saying, like, soul-crushing, depressing, you're going to want to curl up in a fetal position after this news, she says, not so good news. Which helps us go there, helps us not shut down. And then she follows that by good news, earth winds, things that we can be excited about. Is it happening quickly enough? No, let's make it happen more and more quickly. And then she always has a section on what you can do with what we call in class ridiculously easy steps to action. And in fact, my students, when they're graded on their projects, they get points based upon, at the end of their media project, what are the ridiculously easy steps to action. And she always includes this. And we see this also reflected in some of the eco-talkers, where they do their eco-talk, and then they have ridiculously easy steps to action. She is sending the message over and over and over again, in many ways and forms, we are not doomed. Framing climate as being a formidable but solvable problem. So here we all know the OK Boomer retort to the older generation. Here we see a peer-to-peer communication going on of OK Doomer as they're pitching this kind of defiant hope. Another strong media presence in the digital space is Leah Thomas. And I love when she writes here. She's the author of The Intersectional Environmentalist. She has a whole bunch of social media sites having to do with this. But she says, unlike millennials who identify as climate pessimists, a lot of Gen Zers identify with climate fatalism. They believe there is no hope. I get so mad when I see climate communications that say there's no hope, the world's ending. The kids aren't all right. They have eco-anxiety. We have to stop that. So she's talking about it. Shuta's Kat Martinez, who I featured in my Eco-Piety book, and I feature more in this project, who is an indigenous rapper and a climate activist and co-creator of the Guardians, Earth Guardians, as a youth climate activist organization. He, too, is sending the message, hope fuels action, despair dismantles it. So all of these major themes come up in the EcoTalk media making. And just, I'm about to get the cane. So, but I just want to address before that what climate hope means when we use this term climate hope. And it seems that the EcoTalkers are talking about hope in the way that Ellen Kelsey, if you know her work, Hope Matters, and she's also been a fellow at Stanford. She talks about the difference between hope and wishful thinking, that hope is not wishful thinking. Hope is not a pathological Pollyanna delusion. That hope she's referring to is evidence-based hope. And that's part of what Catherine Hayhoe and the other eco-talkers are doing when they post earth winds. Ways we're transitioning, ways we're making a difference, things that are going in the right direction, evidence-based hope. And then these Gen Z eco-communicators are making the point, and then I'll conclude on this, that climate denial and climate fatalism are two sides of the coin of inaction, because the climate fatalism creates this climate paralysis or this eco-anxiety paralysis, and that leads to inaction. Two, that hope is a verb with its shirt sleeves rolled up, as David Orr says, or as Rebecca Solnit says. Hope is not a lottery ticket you can sit on the sofa and clutch feeling lucky. Hope is an axe you break down doors with in an emergency. And I guess I'm out of time, so I'll leave it at that. I had much more to tell you, but maybe we can do that in Q&A.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.